want to worry. Chapter 23. A Day Like Any Other. The second Tuesday in October started out the same as any other. I was late, as usual, because I'd slept in, as usual. I'd stayed up extra late after talking to Moniba, studying for my year-end exam in Pakistani studies. I'd already done a disappointing job on my physics exam, so I would have to get a perfect score on this exam if I was going to take the number one spot back from Malka-e-Noor. It was a point of pride. It was also a sibling thing. If I didn't come in first, I'd never hear the end of it from Khushal. I gulped down a bit of fried egg and chapati with my tea and raced out the door, just in time to catch the bus crammed with other girls on their way to school. I was happy that morning, ridiculously happy. Before I left, my father had been teasing Atal, saying he could be my secretary when I became prime minister. And of course, Atal said no. He would be prime minister, and I would be his secretary. It seemed as if everything in my life was going well. My mother was learning to read. I was on my way to the school I loved, and Moniba and I were friends again. I told myself not to worry about Malka-e-Noor and instead to work hard. And I thought I should thank God for all I had. So I did. I whispered a prayer of thanks before I managed a few last minutes of studying for my exam. "Oh, and God," I said, "please don't forget to give me first place since I have worked so hard." I always prayed the most during exams. Usually, I did not pray on time, which means praying 5 times a day, our religious duty. But at this time of year, my friends and I all prayed on time. I asked for help with my exams or help to come in first in the class. Our teachers always told us, though, God won't give you marks if you don't work hard. God showers us with his blessings, but he is honest as well. So, I always worked hard too. Exam morning passed, and I felt confident I had done well. Afterward, Moniba suggested that we stay behind and wait for the second pickup, which we often did so we could chat before going home. When the diner arrived, I looked around for Atal. My mother had told him to ride home with me that day. But soon I was distracted as the girls gathered around to watch our driver do a magic trick with a disappearing pebble. No matter how hard we tried, we could not figure out his secret. I forgot all about Atal as we piled into the van. We squeezed in and took our usual places, about 20 girls in all. Moniba was next to me, and the rest of my friends were across from us on the other bench. A little girl named Hina grabbed the seat next to me, the spot where my friend Shazia usually sat, forcing Shazia to sit on the bench in the middle, where we often put our backpacks. Shazia looked so unhappy, I asked Hina to move. Just as the van was about to pull away, Atal came running. The doors were shut, but he jumped onto the tailboard on the back. This was a new trick of his, riding home, hanging off the tailboard. It was dangerous, and our bus driver had had enough of it. "Sit inside, Atal," he said. But Atal didn't budge. "Sit inside with the girls, Atal Khan Yusafzai, or I won't take you," the driver said, with more force this time. Atal yelled that he would rather walk home then sit with girls. He jumped down and stormed off in a huff. It was hot and sticky inside the diner as we bounced along Mingora's crowded rush hour streets, and one of the girls started a song to pass the time. The air was thick with the familiar smell of diesel, bread, and kebab mixed with the stench from the nearby stream where everyone dumped trash. We turned off the main road at the army checkpoint as always, and passed the poster that read, "Wanted, terrorists." Just after we passed the Little Giant snack factory, the road became oddly quiet and the bus slowed to a halt. I don't remember a young man stopping us and asking the driver if this was the Khushal school bus, I don't remember the other man jumping onto the tailboard and leaning into the back where we were all sitting. I never heard him ask, "Who is Malala?" And I didn't hear the crack, crack, crack of the three bullets. The last thing I remember is thinking about my exam the next day. After that, everything went black. Part 5. A New Life, Far From Home. Chapter 24. A Place Called Birmingham. I woke up on October 16 to a lot of people standing around looking at me. They all had 4 eyes, 2 noses, and 2 mouths. I blinked, but it did no good. I was seeing everything in double. The first thought I had was, "Thank God, I'm not dead." But I had no idea where I was or who these people were. They were speaking English, although they all seemed to be from different countries. I tried to talk, since I could speak English, but no sound came out. There seemed to be a tube of some kind in my throat, a tube that had stolen my voice. I was in a high bed, and all around me, complicated machines beeped and purred. I understood then. I was in a hospital. My heart clenched in panic. If I was in a hospital, where were my parents? Was my father hurt? Was he alive? Something had happened to me, I knew, but I was sure something had happened to my father as well. A nice woman wearing a headscarf came to my side. She told me that her name was Rehana and that she was the Muslim chaplain. She began to pray in Urdu. Instantly, I felt calm, comforted, and safe. As I listened to the beautiful, soothing words of the Holy Quran, I closed my eyes and drifted off. When I opened my eyes next, I saw that I was in a green room with no windows and very bright lights. The nice Muslim woman was gone. A doctor and a nurse were in her place. The doctor spoke to me in Urdu. His voice was oddly muffled, as if he was speaking from a great distance. He told me that I was safe and that he had brought me from Pakistan. I tried to talk, but couldn't, so I tried to trace letters on my hand, thinking I could spell out a question. The nurse left and came back with a piece of paper and a pen for me, but I couldn't write properly. I wanted to give them my father's number. I wanted to write a question, but everything came out all jumbled. So the nurse wrote the alphabet on a piece of paper, and I pointed at letters. The first word I spelled out was father, then country. Where was my father? I wanted to know. And what country was this? The doctor's voice was still hard to hear, but he seemed to be saying I was in a place called Birmingham. I didn't know where that was. Only later did I figure out it was in England. He hadn't said anything about my father. Why not? Something had happened to him. That was the only reason there could be. I had it in my head that this doctor had found me on the roadside and that he didn't know my father was also hurt, or that he didn't know how to find my father. I wanted to give him my father's phone number so he could tell him, "Your daughter is here." I moved ever so slightly to spell out father again, and a blinding pain cut through my head. It was as if 100 razors were inside my skull, clattering and rattling around. I tried to breathe. Then the nurse leaned down and dabbed at my left ear with a piece of gauze, and blood came away on the cloth. My ear was bleeding. What did that mean? I tried to lift my hand to touch it, but I noticed, as if from a distance, that my hand did not seem to be working properly. What had happened to me? Nurses and doctors came in and out. No one told me anything. Instead, they asked me questions. I nodded and shook my head in reply. They asked if I knew my name. I nodded. They asked if I could move my left hand. I shook my head. They had so many questions, and yet they wouldn't answer mine. It was all too much. The questions, the pain in my head, the worry about my father. When I closed my eyes, I didn't see darkness, only a bright light, as if the sun were shining under my eyelids. I was fading in and out, but I never felt as if I had slept. There was only the long stretches of being awake, my head filled with pain and questions, and then not. The room I was in the ICU and didn't have windows, so I never knew if it was day or night. I knew only that no one had answered my constant question, where was my father? But eventually, a new question joined it when I looked around the room at all the complicated medical equipment. Who would pay for this? A lady walked in and told me her name was Dr. Fiona Reynolds. She spoke to me as if we were old friends. She handed me a green teddy bear, which I thought was an odd color for it, and a pink notebook. The first thing I wrote was, "Thank you." Then I wrote, "Why I have no father," and, "My father has no money. Who will pay for this?" "Your father is safe," she said. "He is in Pakistan. Don't worry about the payment." If my father was safe, why wasn't he here? And where was my mother? I had more questions for Dr. Fiona, but the words I needed would not come to my mind. She seemed to understand. "Something bad happened to you," she said. "But you're safe now." What had happened? I tried to remember. All sorts of images floated through my head. I didn't know what was real and what was a dream. I am on a bus with my father, and two men shoot us. I see a crowd gathered around me as I lie on a bed, or maybe a stretcher. I can't see my father, and I'm trying to cry out, "Where is Abba? Where is my father?" But I can't speak. And then I see him, and I feel joy and relief. I feel someone hovering over me, a man whose hands are poised above my neck, ready to choke me. I am on a stretcher, and my father is reaching out to me. I am trying to wake up to go to school, but I can't. Then I see my school and my friends, and I can't reach them. I see a man in black pointing a gun at me. I see doctors trying to stick a tube in my throat. I am telling myself, "You are dead," but then I realize that the angel has not yet come to ask the questions a Muslim hears after death. Who is your God? Who is your prophet? I realize then I can't be dead, and I fight and struggle and kick and try to wake from this terrible nightmare. These images seemed very real, yet I knew they couldn't all be. But somehow I had ended up in this place called Birmingham, in a room full of machines, with only the green teddy bear at my side. Chapter 25. Problems, Solutions. In those first days of being in the hospital, my mind drifted in and out of a dream world. I thought I had been shot, but I wasn't sure. Were those dreams or memories? I couldn't remember words either. I wrote to the nurses asking for a wire to clean my teeth. I had a pounding, non-stop headache. I was seeing double. I could hardly hear. I couldn't move my left arm or close my left eye. But for some reason, all I wanted to do was floss my teeth. "Your teeth are fine," the doctors said, "but your tongue has gone numb." I tried to shake my head. No, I wanted to explain. There was something stuck in my teeth. But shaking my head set off the razor blade pain, so I held still. I couldn't convince them, and they couldn't convince me. Then I saw that my green teddy bear was gone. A white one had taken its place. I felt a special affection for the green teddy bear, since he was by my side that first day. He helped me. I took the notebook and wrote, "Where's the green teddy?" No one gave me the answer I wanted. They said it was the same teddy that had been by my side the first day. The lights and walls had given him a green glow, but the teddy was white, they said. He was always white. Meanwhile, the bright lights in my room were excruciating, like hot white daggers to my eyes, especially in my poor left eye, which wouldn't close. "Stop lights," I begged in my notebook. The nurses did their best to darken the room, but as soon as I got some relief from the pain, my thoughts circled back to my father. "My father," I wrote again in the notebook. "When you can't move, you can't hear, and you can't see properly, your mind spins and spins," and my mind kept going back to the same question. Where was my father? Every time a different doctor or nurse came into my room to change my blanket or check my eyesight, I handed them the notebook and pointed to the questions about my father. They all said not to worry. But I did worry. I couldn't stop. I was also obsessed with how we would pay for all this. Whenever I saw the doctors and nurses talking to each other, I thought for sure they were saying, "Malala doesn't have any money. Malala can't pay for her treatment." There was one doctor who always looked sad, so I wrote him a note. "Why are you sad?" I asked. I thought it was because he knew I couldn't pay. But he replied, "I'm not sad." "Who will pay?" I wrote. "We don't have any money." "Don't worry, your government will pay," he said. After that, he always smiled when he saw me. Then a new worry seized me. Did my parents know where I was? Maybe they were wandering the streets and alleys of Mingora looking for me. But I am a hopeful person, and therefore, when I see problems, I will always think about solutions. So I thought I would go to the hospital's reception desk and ask for a phone so I could call my parents. But then I realized I didn't have the money to pay for such an expensive call. I didn't even know how to dial Pakistan from here. Then I thought, I need to go out and start working to earn money so I can buy a phone and call my family so we can all be together again. Dr. Fiona came into my room and handed me a newspaper clipping. It was a picture of my father standing next to the Pakistan Army's chief of staff. My father was alive, and in the background of the photo was Atal. I smiled. Something bad had happened to me, but I was alive, and now I knew my father was alive. That was a reason to be thankful. Then I noticed a figure in a shawl, sitting in the back of the photo near my brother. I could just make out her feet. Those were my mother's feet. "That's my mother," I wrote to Dr. Fiona. That night, I slept a bit better. It was a sleep full of strange dreams. Dreams of being on a bed surrounded by lots of people. Dreams of being shot. Dreams of a bomb exploding. I would wake up and look around for the green teddy. But always it was just the white one. Now that I knew my family was safe, I spent all my time worrying about how we would pay for my treatment. Obviously, my father was at home, because he was selling our few possessions to pay for all this. Our house was rented, the school building was too. Even if he sold everything we owned, it would never be enough. Was he borrowing money? Was he calling on his friends to ask for a loan? Later that day, the man who had spoken to me in Urdu, Dr. Javed Kayani, came in with his cell phone. "We're going to call your parents," he said, matter-of-factly. I couldn't believe it. "You won't cry," he said firmly. "You won't weep. You will be strong. We don't want your family to worry." I nodded. I hadn't cried once since I'd arrived. My left eye was constantly weeping, but I had not cried. After a series of blips and beeps, I heard my father's dear and familiar voice. "Jani," he said. "How are you feeling, my Jani?" I couldn't reply because of the tube in my throat, and I couldn't smile because my face was numb. But I was smiling inside, and I knew my father knew that. I'll come soon, my father said.